Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by...
from Niles, Ohio, Bob Bazanko.
And just before we get started, I just want to remind people that our program is made through the generosity of our audience. So please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/greenandredpodcast or make a one-time donation at greenandredpodcast.org /donate. Today, we're going to be talking about low-wage workers in grocery stores. And joining us to do that is Ann Larson, who is an activist and writer focused on economic justice. She's a co-founder of The Debt Collective, and then is the author of a new book coming out this week, I believe, Clean Up on Aisle 5, Essential Work, Poverty, Wages, and the View from Behind the Supermarket Register, which is, for folks who are familiar, it struck me as very much like a Barbara Ehrenreich investigation and reflection on what it's like to be working in a grocery store. But Anne, welcome to the Green and Red podcast.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And maybe just to start off, what... you're founder of the Debt Collective. You were involved in that in the 2010s, let's say. Yeah. But then during the pandemic, you were back in Salt Lake City or in Salt Lake City during the pandemic and began to work at a grocery store. What brought you to your employment at the supermarket, which is, I believe, a sort of gnome de plume of a grocery store named TGS?
That's right. Thanks for that introduction. I appreciate the question. I have a long sort of history on the left as an activist, writer, and organizer. I was involved in Occupy Wall Street. I used to live in New York City. Now I live in Salt Lake City. And that I struggled for a long time with, like a lot of people, with securing stable employment. I worked did a lot of adjunct gigs as a graduate student, never was able to land a full-time academic job. One of the themes of my book is my poor timing throughout my life. I graduated from graduate school in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. So it's really bad timing. It's hard. And then co-founded an organization called the Debt Collective around 2013-14. And the goal there was to collaborate with borrowers who had attended these scam for-profit colleges in order to win debt relief. And so this was part of a larger political project of advocating for public goods, free public college, universal health care, things like that. But we started with these scams for public college students. And that was a pretty successful campaign, to make a long story short. Took a long time, many years of battles with the Obama administration and after, but we did win billions in debt relief. But like my experience in higher ed, trying to keep the organization afloat financially was always a challenge. Eventually, I found myself unemployed in approaching middle age, unemployed, and not really sure what to do. I moved back, I thought temporarily, to my home state of Utah to regroup, figure out what was next. Again, poor timing on my part. The pandemic hit pretty much right at that moment. So I was unable to find work. And I started shopping at this grocery store near my apartment. And I would see that it's the beginning of the pandemic. Nobody knows how bad this is going to get. We're all panicked. City's on lockdown, but these people are showing up to go to work so the rest of us can buy food. And I was very impressed by this, but also a little guilty, I think. And I didn't like being isolated at home. And I needed money and I needed health insurance. So I didn't have either of those things. I ended up taking a job at the store. I was hired as a supervisor of cashiers, which was weird because I'd never been a cashier before. But I think during that time, there was a lot, they needed people. And I had management experience. So anyway, long story short, I didn't expect to make a career at the supermarket. I was biding my time, trying to figure out what was next in a weird transitional moment in my life. But 13 months later, when I left that job, I knew that I needed to tell the story of what I had experienced and what I had learned. So that's Clean Up on Aisle 5.
To get started, because we learned in COVID that people who work at stores like that are considered essential, right? Which sounds like it has some gravitas, but I think you know better than anybody. But what's the wage system like in a grocery store? Because we go there and we spend more now on food than we have been before. But in general, we go there, we buy a bunch of food, spend a lot of money. How much of that are the workers getting?
Virtually nothing. When I was on the job, average wages in the industry were under $15 an hour. That was a couple years ago. I was a supervisor. I earned $15.80 an hour. I was hired at $15.80. Now, once, if you want to get the company health insurance, which most people that I work with, or many people that I work with, did not opt to do that because of the cost, but it was about $40 a week that you had to kick in, which is a lot for somebody earning $15, $18 an hour or under. So this is poverty wages. I worked with many workers who were food insecure themselves, who relied on SNAP and other food aid programs to survive. I tell stories in the book about people not being able to afford lunch on their lunch break. Healthcare, nobody could afford healthcare. They were, many people were sick and injured and had nowhere to turn, no recourse. One of the things that I think we should sit with as a society is that we have a retail food system where the people that sell food cannot afford to buy it. And so on the job, I saw the effects of that, and almost everybody was struggling economically. So I would say during the pandemic too, in terms of how much these corporations raked in billions there. They've always done very well. Grocery companies are flush with cash, but during the pandemic, especially companies like Kroger experienced a windfall. And what they did with those profits is they sent it to shareholders, right? So big grocery companies, it's no longer about, oh, we sell groceries and then we take those profits and we invest it back into the business. No, all these big corporations are financialized. And so they have investors and shareholders that anticipate returns. And so when that money came in during the pandemic, they did not use it to raise wages, improve conditions in stores, or lower prices for shoppers. They sent it to shareholders, and huge buybacks during that period really revealed how the grocery industry works these days.
They also had a big merger too. Oh, sorry.
Oh, let me. Oh, go ahead.
They also had a big merger in this period as well. It was Albertsons, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. The Albertsons tried to merge Safeway. I don't know if that's the one you're referring to. And the FTC blocked it. And one of the reasons they blocked it is, this was the Lena Khan FTC. One of the reasons they blocked it was because they said, the FTC said, when we have concentrated power at the top of an industry like this, it means higher prices for shoppers and it suppresses wages for workers. We can get into, I talk in the book about the history of sort of monopolization of the retail industry. And one of the myths of the sort of Reagan era 1980s is that the bigger the company, the better service they'll be able to provide shoppers and consumers will benefit, right? We have a consumer economy. But what we've found over the last few decades is just oodles of evidence that the larger and more concentrated an industry, the higher prices are and the lower wages are. So that's what we're in right now in the supermarket, where the beneficiaries are investors and shareholders, not workers or shoppers.
Bob, did you have a question?
No, go ahead. I'll come back later.
Okay. My other question was about the workers. There's no sick days, vacation days, talked about health insurance, 401k, all of that. None of that is the grocery workers.
Not a thing. Very rare. In my store, you had to work a year full time to earn points towards big time off. Right? So once you'd worked a year, then you started earning points towards. So you had to work 2 or 3 years, 4 years before you could qualify for any length of time. So one research called it our no vacation nation. And this is true across industries. About 1 in 4 U.S. workers can never take a paid vacation, ever. Whereas it can be different. We see in Europe and other places, retail workers, especially the ones that are unionized, they have weeks of vacation guaranteed off every year. They can take time off. They can spend time with their family. They can go to the beach. They can just stay home, read a book, whatever. We simply don't have that system here. So what I saw at the supermarket was that it's already a physically difficult job, physically exhausting. People, if you want to take time off, it's unpaid. So people engage in all sorts of trickery. Employees engage in all sorts of trickery to try to get time off. They would sign up for a brutal shift, a brutal schedule of 12 shifts in a row where you're just killing yourself. But at the end of that 12 shifts, you could get 4 or 5 days off in a row. And that was a vacation, right? So people would go camping or something on their 4 days off. But then you'd have to come back. And if you wanted to do that again, you'd have to pick up multiple shifts in a row. So people had different strategies that they used to try to get time off, but there was no guaranteed or mandated vacation days.
To go back to the COVID year, I remember you mentioned Kroger's. I was a professor in Houston for 30 years. So I was living in Houston and went to Kroger's all the time. And I think they gave them a $2 raise. And then after, I don't know how long, wasn't that long, they took it back. They revoked that. But the thing that I keep thinking about is because I'm old, right? So I grew up in an era where working in a grocery store was romanticized. It was like a high school kid part-time job or the summer college work or whatever. And now for quite some time, you go to Kroger's or wherever, and I think you see a much different type of worker. What's the kind of typical work situation there for people? Because you mentioned $15 an hour, which is barely $30,000 a year before taxes.
One of the fastest growing demographics of grocery workers is older people.
Yeah.
Right. This is a phenomenon that we can see, especially since 2008. People, a lot of baby boomers lost homes during the financial crisis, and that's one factor. But so what we see now, I had a colleague in my store who was 79. She was a bagger when I began working with her. She'd been at the store 9 years. And so she was typical of this group of elderly retail workers. And I asked her, why are you working in a grocery store well past retirement age? And she said, my Social Security does not allow me to live. She had been a mother, raised 4 kids, right? So she didn't have a long track record of work, which is a lot often the case for women. But she also said, I like working here. What would I do at home? So one of the things that I try to bring out in the book is these complicated stories from the supermarket. Obviously, a 79-year-old woman that has to work in a supermarket to make ends meet should shock the conscience and is a social crime that we should all be very concerned about. We've seen viral videos of the 80-year-old Walmart worker stooped over their register. But this woman in my store had to work, but she also enjoyed coming into the supermarket. All the customers knew her, right? They would line up at her register so they could get her to bag their stuff. She loved talking to the kids who came through the line. So I think that the story here is economic precarity and poverty, but it's also elderly people being isolated and lonely, and the supermarket becomes a place where you can have a social life. And that was certainly the case for her. But supermarkets, retail stores, warehouses, they are taking advantage of precarity among the elderly to recruit. These stores see older workers as a real benefit because they're often very experienced, right? They have a long work history that they can draw from. They're good at their jobs. They like my colleague, they can be very good at customer service. And so companies are benefiting from the fact that significant numbers of older people in our country cannot afford to retire.
Quick follow up, because one of the things you hear from everybody, and I know people who own places, is no one wants to work, right? Or I went into the store, nobody was working. And is this kind of intentional that you don't sometimes have adequate staff? Purposely, they don't want to pay the wages. There's 20 people in a line and there's 2 checkouts open. Or I go to Aldi's now and there's only 1 checkout available. The rest are all self-checkouts, which is something I want to ask you about too. But is that staffing issue intentional because they just don't want to pay the wages?
It's absolutely intentional. Absolutely intentional. The retail industry is famous for what's it called, just-in-time scheduling. They only schedule workers when they believe they will absolutely be needed. And that's even, and what they mean by that is the bare minimum that they can get away with. One big theme in my book is me as a supervisor trying to manage the store with half of the workers that I needed running between stations. And people called out sick a lot. For one thing, it was during COVID, but also there's a lot of no-shows. People just, when you're in a low-wage job where you know that no one cares about you, you find something better, or maybe you just don't show up. There's constant staffing upheaval, staffing turmoil in a retail store. And when I was on the job, right before the self-checkout machines were installed, my manager, I walked into the office one day, and one of the managers that I worked closely with, she looked really nervous. She was looking at her computer screen. I said, what's up? And she said, the bosses have instructed me to cut 200 hours from the schedule this week because profits are a little bit down. And so we have to make that up with labor cuts. And so she said to me, I don't know how we're going to do it. I don't know how we're going to get by. I had multiple shifts where I showed up to manage the store and there was nobody but me who had showed up to work. We called it the front end, right? The cash register area. So yes, it's all by design. It's all to cut costs. And one thing I hope readers will get out of the book is if you go into a store and it seems understaffed, or maybe the workers there seem frenzied or over pressured, or maybe they're a little bit short with you, you might, instead of thinking, what's wrong with these workers? Why don't they do their jobs? You might think, what are the conditions here that are producing this situation that we're all struggling with?
And you mentioned you had just started when they started doing self-checkout, and I'd never go to those. How did that become a source of aggravation? Because when I do see people doing self-checkout, there's always some glitch and they have to call somebody over anyway. And personally, I won't do it, but how did that play into this? And I'm sure that increased profits as well.
See, so interesting. When I first got the job at the store, there were no self-checkouts. It was all traditional check stands. And then a couple of months in, we got a memo saying they were going to replace about a third of the register in the store with self-checkout machines. So I got to see this sort of transition from only human cashiers to the new regime of the self-checkouts and what that was like. And I will say, it's certainly true. This has made me, I've been an automation / AI skeptic the whole bit because of this experience. It's certainly true in our store, one cashier would monitor six machines. So we used to have, where you might have six cashiers before, now you have one person who's one. So absolutely. And this worried people. My colleagues were concerned. They were dumb. They knew, okay, this is going to mean they're going to lay people off. They won't hire. But what actually happened is what you said. The machines break down all the time. They glitch. There are constant technical problems. It's inevitable. So I, as a supervisor, you can learn how to fix something, but I'm on the phone all the time with tech support. I'm calling. This machine is glitching. I'm getting this error message. What do I do? So now the company is paying me to call tech support, and they're also paying the person on the phone to talk to me, right? And this is labor that they are paying. There were also if there was a serious problem, and this was pretty regular, guys would show up to fix them. And so there would be like these repair people. It was amazing, tool belts, screwdrivers and tools hanging, like they're working on an oil rig, right? And they come and open panels and they're like pulling out wires. And so this is a group of employees that now have to be hired to come and fix broken machines. So yes, I think that cashiers, they needed fewer cashiers to run the store, but they're hiring all these other workers to maintain the machines. I'm skeptical that labor saving is really happening there. Secondly, as you also alluded to, a lot of the bad encounters between shoppers and workers happened at the self-checkout machines. When these machines break down, or when they don't perform like you think, or customers don't know how to use these machines. You want to buy a cucumber, you have to enter a produce code. How many cucumbers are you buying? You want to buy a mushroom. What kind of mushrooms are they? I don't know, brown ones. And sometimes you need the help of the cashier. If you want to buy alcohol, you have to show your ID. So they can be, you expect an efficient, convenient experience, and what you encounter is something different. And so you get angry at the worker. So many of the bad encounters between shoppers and workers occurred at the machine. So I just think the automation exacts a social cost that we also need to take into account. One of the pleasures of working at the store and of shopping in one is, you know, your cashier, you go through the register. Hey, how you doing, Barbara? And that person knows your kids and knows what you like to buy on Taco Tuesday, whatever.
Right.
None of that. There's no regulars. There's no chatty banter at the self-checkout. It's simply the only reason that a customer might talk to you is because they're frustrated or something isn't working. So, yeah. Two things is that the labor saving element, I think, is questionable. And I think that's applicable across different kinds of automation. And then social costs are really serious.
Has it also increased the shoplifting? I know a lot of our grad students would liberate, you know, they buy a nice steak.
Well, I think with a scan, yes.
Yeah, take a nice steak and put a $1.99 sticker on it or something like that.
Shoplifting is one of the most loved checkout. We saw it every day. And
liberation, not shoplifting.
Yeah.
It does push
on employees, because employees are supposed to stop shoplift. There's an implicit requirement that employees are supposed to stop shoplifting. So when you see it and you're standing there earning $15 an hour and you see somebody who's stealing, then do you go and confront that person? Is that your job as a low wage worker? Right. So that's another way where, and in my experience in the store, cashiers do not want to be stolen from. Right. When you're a cashier and you see somebody who's stealing, a cashier once reported that to me from the self-checkout. What she said is, someone stole from me today. So there's a kind of offense that workers take when they feel like nobody wants to be duped. Nobody wants to be taken advantage of. So on the one hand, sure, liberate Whole Foods, absolutely. But it does have an effect on the staff that I think is really, that can have negative consequences. It's very anti-solidaristic, I think, in a way.
You talk about the security guards and you talk about surveillance, and there's a lot of articles out there about surveillance at grocery stores and other low wage retail kind of jobs, mm-hmm. from like Starbucks or whatever. But like, I'm kind of curious, how much was it punitive? If you're a cashier and someone was able to dupe you and steal something from the company, was it punitive from the company on the worker?
In terms of shoplifting?
Yeah.
What I will say is no one ever told us that we were, our job was to stop shoplifters, because I think even a manager knows that's an unreasonable demand. But for this happened to me. I'm supervising the front end, and there's a young 19-year-old cashier monitoring the six self checkout stations. And he's young and he's a little bit new to the job, but he's also distracted. He's not the greatest employee. And a manager came over to me and said, I think we need to replace so-and-so on the self-checkouts. I said, why? And she said, I don't think he's alert enough to notice when somebody's stealing. So it was stuff like that where I was being instructed to make sure there was somebody at self-checkout who, I don't know, had the, maybe shoplifters might be a little intimidated by, or who would be less likely to steal, but here they see this kind of young, distracted worker and they're going to be more likely to steal. So it was more stuff like that. I will say surveillance is a huge issue in the supermarket. This is one thing I did not know about and I did not expect. You are monitored from the moment you walk in to the moment you leave. There are cameras hanging from the ceiling above every check stand, cameras on the doors. This is a whole security office where a security team is watching the monitors. There are, in my store, security guards roaming the aisles with tasers. I mean, really kind of like a carceral environment in some ways. There was an incident I described where, and this can put employees, and so all the surveillance is aimed at shoppers too. They're being watched just like we are. There was an incident I described in the book where a shoplifter was trying to steal. This was late at night. He was probably a homeless person, came in late at night and tried to steal donuts and milk. And was running out the door, and a security guard tackles him. And there's this violent encounter that he witnessed, that I witnessed. And all my colleagues who were there witnessed it too. And in fact, when the security guard was hunting the guy through the store, and he called me on the radio and he said, can you let me know when that guy gets to the front? And so I did. So the guy called. I saw the shoplifter, and I responded and I said, yeah, he's here. And then he rushes up and tackles the guy. And so I felt bad. I feel guilty. I'd helped to precipitate this violent encounter with somebody who wanted to steal donuts because he was hungry. And the next day, a colleague came up to me, and he'd been there that night too. And he said, we tased the guy over donuts and milk last night. So here we are doing these hard, thankless customer service jobs. We also feel implicated in these attempts to stop shoplifting and the surveillance that's going on in the store. We're being conscripted into this carceral system. It's pretty, right. It's pretty bleak.
You also, at the beginning of the book, you talk about a supervisor who had been fired from another supermarket because she priced down some expired meat and was like very affected by that, to say the least. But like, how much there's the surveillance that goes on of shoplifters or homeless people coming in or people who they deem maybe sketchy or whatever, but like, how much is the surveillance also going on of the employees?
Yes, that's exactly right. Employees are surveilled constantly. Things I didn't know as a cashier, the register records how fast you're scanning. So it knows how fast you're working, and we would get regular weekly or monthly reports. The manager of the front end would put a list, tape it to the wall so everyone can see, right, with your IPMs, your items per minute, and you would be in a list with other employees. So you see how you stack up against other workers and how fast you're going. So there's pressure to speed up your scanning speeds. I attended a manager's meeting once where that was the top item on the agenda. How can we speed up scanning speeds? How can we get people to work faster? Which creates injury, right? It creates repetitive stress injuries, which I talk about quite at length in the book. Other kinds of surveillance.
That sounds like Amazon warehouse stuff, kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's modern Taylorism. Yeah.
Right. Modern Taylorism, absolutely. Another thing that might interest you folks too is that when you clock in for your shift, it's biometrics. You put your finger on a scanner and it scans your fingerprint. And that's how you clock in and out, and for your coming and going, but also for your breaks. So that means you can't trick it. You can't. I'm gonna clock in for my friend who's 10 minutes late to work so they can get their hours. You can't do that. You gotta have the people come. But in researching the book, one thing I found was that this fingerprint scanning technology, if you go back and look at the history, it was first introduced by this company called Identimation, which is now called G4S. And this is a security firm with ties to the private prison industry. And in 2016, S protected the Dakota Access Pipeline, against protesters at Standing Rock in North Dakota. Folks might remember that.
I remember G4S at Standing Rock. They were, yeah, I think they were involved in the program.
Well, yeah, they're involved all sorts of stuff. And since 2013, this is incredibly relevant. See, also, since 2003, they provided security for Immigration Customs Enforcement. In the book, I make the case that there are these links between policing, between war, and our workplace timekeeping mechanisms just in your regular retail store. They're watching you every step of the way.
Something else you talked about, which Scott and I are familiar with, we used to do a lot of stuff with groups like Food Non-Bombs, who would sometimes go dumpster diving, which kind of brings up the question of waste, right? How much stuff in that grocery store is just tossed, is just thrown away?
Yeah, I did not know about this either, and this is shocking. In researching the book, I learned food waste occurs all along the supply chain from the farm. You imagine from the farm or the factory, you've got to pack it up, you've got to transport it, you've got to keep it at a controlled temperature. You've got to keep it away from vermin and insects all the way to the store. And there are losses all along that chain. But then when you get to the store, one study said that about 30% of food waste happens after food has reached stores. And the main reason is because of the buzzword these days is abundance, right? Is stores over order. They order. When you walk into a store, the idea is you're supposed to see choice and diversity in the shelves full of products, right? Nobody wants to walk into a grocery store and the thinking goes and see the shelves half full or it looks weird, like what's going on, right? You want to walk in and see full display cases. And so because of that, stores over order and they end up throwing out products that expire, that go bad, or even ones that get dented, bruised bananas, things like that, all get tossed out. All for this appearance of abundance is actually an illusion. One of my colleagues at the store who worked in the deli, we had in our store a big case for rotisserie chickens that are spinning in this case. And well, that had to be full at all times. You don't want to walk up to the rotisserie case and see one chicken that looks weird somehow. And so they would fill the case and then it wouldn't sell. And so this person told me at the end of every night, we're throwing out a dozen or more, 20 chickens. We just throw them in the trash. Can't sell them.
If a community group came and said, hey, can we get that? Would they do it? Oh.
I don't know why. It's probably some insurance thing. They have whatever, but no, they throw it right in the garbage.
Yeah. This is soft, but I also have, I always get into it with people about expiration dates, which are just suggestions and people always, oh, I can't believe you. Oh, it's fine. Like half and half. That'll last. If you don't open it, it'll last 2 months, right? And so I think that's a scam too, to get people to throw stuff away, which is perfectly fine. Yeah.
Go back to the store and buy it to be half and half. Yeah.
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 Go ahead, Scott. I kind of going off the trails here.
No, it's okay. It's okay. The other thing I was interested in, just a little back on the surveillance thing, is the amount of snitching, I guess, as we call it around here, of employees on employees, which seems pretty crazy. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that.
There's an incredible...
Informing, I guess is the polite
way. Yeah, there's an incredible amount of snitching between employees at my store. And I was surprised at it, but I understood it after I'd been there a while. This is the place where people are, as we've already discussed, low wages, financially precious, don't know where the next meal is coming from. And so in that kind of pressure cooker environment, and also when your body's, you're sick and injured, right? Your enemy is the person next to you at the next workstation. That person is, maybe they make a dollar an hour more than you. Maybe they're up for promotion and you're not, or maybe whatever, right? You tend to see your colleagues and maybe your direct supervisor as somebody who is your antagonist. You don't necessarily think, oh, I know that. We all know that the policy, you don't know them, they don't come into your store, but you do see your supervisor or your fellow coworkers. And so you tend to take out your frustrations on folks that should be your allies, right? There was an incident where managers know this. And so they know they can pit people against each other. And so managers, in one case, managers ask a security guard. The security guards are normally, their job is watching shoplifters, right? But in this case, they asked him, we suspect that one of your colleagues is spending a lot of time during his shift he was a custodial staff member. We suspect he's spending a lot of time during shift in the mop closet watching videos on his phone, not working. And so you keep an eye on him. And so the security guard tells me, I'm going to go look at the surveillance video from outside the hall. Because again, every area is filmed, right? And see when he goes in and when he comes out so we can see how long he's been spending in there. And I said, are you sure you want to do that? But he shrugged and said, And that's just what I've been asked to do. And in his mind, I work. I come in, I work my full 8-hour shift. I don't hide in the closet and watch videos. So why should he, right? I understand that logic. And it turned out he was spending time, lots of time in the mop closet watching videos. And so he got in trouble. It was the whole, he got what's called written up. He got a reprimand put in his employee file. And it was because a colleague informed on him. And this is incredibly common in these.
Because similar to that, there have been times when something wouldn't scan or I had a coupon, they claimed it was expired, or I tried to return products and I didn't have the receipt. And it became a hassle. And my first thought is, this is a $1 billion corporation. Why are you doing their dirty work? But is there pressure on people? Would they get in trouble if they like gave me a refund on a bad product or gave me a replacement if I didn't have a receipt for it? Or
they'd probably be fired. I mean,
really?
Oh, yeah.
Because I always ask to see the manager. I don't want to hassle somebody, but it's just amazing where $1.99 product and they won't give me a refund on it, which is like obviously bad.
We talked, maybe a manager quit. I saw a couple of stitches, but certainly anybody who's just working there and is like, a check, they cannot, they will be. I knew people who got fired because, or threatened with being fired because they gave somebody a discount or.
Yeah, one time I got like the 18 ounce blueberry instead of the 12, and they wouldn't give me the 30 cents off or something like this. I'm spending more money, actually.
Yes, that's a really good point. There's such a level of distrust. When you're working the cash register and a member of your family comes in, like you're supposed to call a manager to stand there.
God, are you serious?
Because this food's going to your house, right? Or to a member of your family. And so they don't trust you. I'm not going to scan this package of spaghetti, huh?
Stronger standards than the Pentagon does or the Department of Justice.
I had to call a manager over when a member of my family came through the line so that she could watch me scan. Absolutely. Tight security.
It feels very nickel and dime. On the kind of like flip side of some of that is you talk a lot about like how there's like a community has developed as well and people support each other. One thing that strikes me from the book is like how a lot of the workers didn't have cars or couldn't afford cars. And so the ones who did carpool, right? And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the community aspects of the workers at the store.
Yeah, so far I've made the supermarket just sound like a horrible hellscape. And it is.
Totalitarian state.
But one of the themes of the book is the kind of split screen of the supermarket that on the one hand, there's this sort of dark side, which we've already talked about a lot, of low wages and poverty and surveillance and snitching. But there's also a really wonderful positive side that I did not expect. And there's a lot of solidarity between colleagues in that incident you mentioned. So I'm working at the store during COVID. Most people don't have cars. They can't afford them. People take the bus to work. But at night, when we would close the store, one of our colleagues had a car. And so he called it his taxi service. And every night when he was there, he would drive. We would climb in the back seat and he would drop people off. And this is wherever they lived in the city. He would drive there and drop them off before he went home. And we used to joke because we'd be crammed in the back seat. We're all getting COVID tonight, right? Because we're all sitting on each other's laps or whatever. But this was a service and he just did it every night. And it cost him gas money. He was just working there like we were, but he did that. And that happened all the time where there was moments of solidarity, moments of care. So one of the challenges of working in the store and with customer service too, I talk in the book about there are plenty of rude customers who could ruin your day with their insulting comments, but there are plenty of wonderful people who you enjoy serving. They make service work a pleasure and they talk to you. How are you doing? How are you holding up? And they know you by name and they ask your advice about things. And customer service is not inherently bad. It can be a social exchange that is pleasant and where each party feels they get something out of it. So one of the challenges of working in a store like this is you never know which side of the split screen you're going to get from one shift to the next or one moment to the next. It can be quite feeling of you're living in this contradiction and a sense of whiplash that can occur.
There were really high COVID rates, weren't there, among grocery workers?
Yeah. It was a higher percentage than in the population.
Yeah. But you got $2 an hour extra and you were considered heroes.
Yeah, we did not. So the $2 an hour extra, some big chains did offer that for a few months during the pandemic, but most grocery workers did not get that. And it was called heroes pay. So this is something we acknowledged very briefly in society at that moment that these folks, like healthcare workers and others, were sacrificing their safety for other people and that they should be compensated for that. And one of the things I think one of the failures of that moment is that those gains were not permanent. There were no permanent gains for working people that came out of that moment. And that breaks my heart. I think that shows a failure of organizing and being able to, and we were all frightened. And in some ways I understand the impulse to just go home and isolate and protect your own. But I think we missed an opportunity there as the left, as labor, you know, to push for some permanent gains.
There was a great deal of leverage. You were essential workers. Right? Are you familiar with the chain HEB in Texas at all? It seems different. I think they seem a little better. I know it was like during COVID, I quit going to Kroger and started going to HEB. They're very active in the community. As soon as COVID hit, they sent a team to China to study it. And I've talked to people who work there who seem to have a pretty decent. So I guess it can be different. I don't know. But anyway, that's off the path. So I'm just curious.
That's kind of talking about on that theme is with the, was there, I Salt Lake City is a very conservative place and it's a right to work state. So I'm assuming there was like no union organizing of grocery workers going on, but was there any kind of labor solidarity going on in any of these cases where if the management did something super egregious that the workers would support another worker?
I never heard the word union uttered in the store. Utah is the right to quote unquote right to work state. There are high barriers to organizing. Honestly, I'm sure I could come up with examples where workers supported each other in the face of management pressure. There was certainly a lot of grumbling behind the scenes, right? On the self-checkout machines. There's one example. When the self-checkout machines were installed, the day that they were installed, there was an executive from the corporate office there, and she was supervising the installation of these machines. And I was standing there with one of the long-term cashiers, and he surprised me by pushing back against her, and he said, "These machines, you're going to take people's jobs away." She was dismissive and said, "No, they're not. That's ridiculous." And so I followed this cashier back to his register with a couple of other people. We were expressing our gratitude to him for saying that because we were all afraid to say anything. And he said, "Yeah, she thinks we're all stupid." Right. So there are moments like that where you're behind the curtain acting in solidarity with each other. But it's pretty difficult to do outside of in a more public way or in a way that might jeopardize you. In terms of, I didn't know any other unionized grocery stores in the area. I didn't know union worker ever, no organizer ever showed up at the store to talk to us. I talk in the book about a kind of dilemma that I had while I was working there. I had an organizing background. I knew that collectivizing our struggles was the way to solve some of these problems. And I considered trying to start organizing conversations, trying to get a union going. But a couple of things stopped me. One was that I was afraid of putting my colleagues in jeopardy. I didn't know what my future held, but I figured I wasn't going to be at the grocery store forever. I could figure out how to get back to the white collar world at some point. And I didn't want to set something in motion that I wouldn't be there to see through. And people were afraid. People needed their jobs, right? There's a lot of fear, a lot of unspoken fear. And I didn't want to risk that so that I could make myself feel better. Yes, I am doing the right thing by bringing my political analysis into this space. That didn't seem appropriate to me. I wrestled with that a little bit, whether I did the right thing there, but in the end, I chose to work at the store, and my solidarity came out in other ways, which I write about in the book, for better or worse, but I did not approach the subject of union, and I wouldn't have known I would have to have made calls, I don't know, to the UFCW regional office myself. There was no sense that, okay, if we want to do this, we know where to go and who to talk to. That wasn't, this is, the way I describe it in the book is that the idea of unions and of having a labor movement exists in another universe that we didn't live in.
Do you know what percentage, not in Utah, but nationally, what percentage?
Yeah, it's about 5%.
About 5%.
Yeah, so we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. You talk about food deserts, which I think is just in general been a bigger theme in the last few years. And I lived in 3 or 4 different places in Houston at one point near campus, which is a faculty, nice neighborhood. But then we're surrounded by a rough area and there was a Kroger's there. And there are Kroger's all over Houston, probably, I think, the biggest chain. But the store near campus, a lot of people walked or rode bikes there. It was a poor neighborhood. And the prices were way higher than in the River Oaks area, the River Oaks Kroger, which is the wealthy oil kind of people. Is that, like, how does that play out there? They know they have a captive audience, so they can charge them whatever.
Yeah, the reason that we have food deserts is, and last I checked, about 50 million people lived in food deserts, meaning there's no grocery store within a mile. That's in a city. And then if you live in a rural area, it's 10 miles. And they are mostly located in low-income neighborhoods. It's very Black customers are twice as likely as whites to live in one, which is why some people call it food apartheid, right? It's a bit of food desert. And the reason that food deserts exist is because corporations don't want to invest in communities where they can't make a profit, right? That's the number one reason. So if Kroger doesn't think if they put up a store, they're going to make money, they won't do it. There's no sense of we have an obligation to serve all communities, or even if the store isn't going to pull in as much profit as the one down the street does, we're going to put a store here because people in this neighborhood need one. Absolutely not. These corporations are totally rapacious. They make decisions solely based on the bottom line. And they also push out a lot of small businesses, right?
Yeah.
I tell a story in the book about Walmart opening a store. I think it was in Texas, and in this Texas community, and all small businesses closed, right? Because they can't compete. And then a couple of years later, Walmart realizes they're not making any money, so they pull up snakes and leave. And there you go. You've got a food desert, because there used to be small grocers there and small businesses, and now they're gone. So it's not only that these big stores don't invest in community, often that even when they do, they create problems that just ripple through the community for years.
Did you study like how kind of the grocery industry is set up elsewhere in Europe or anywhere? Because there's a great book about 15 years ago called Irresistible Empire, and the woman who wrote it, Victoria de Gracia, great book, talks about the introduction of American supermarkets into Europe and how unsettling that was. And I think about 20 years ago, there was a great story where in Germany, the local municipality sued Walmart because they had moved in and were selling goods so cheap that they were undercutting the local businesses, and that was against the law. And I think
Yeah, there are laws in other countries in Europe against these kind of monopolistic practices, right?
Yeah.
A company comes in and takes over a market. Now, I will say that there are laws, anti-monopoly laws in the U.S. that we are not enforcing, right?
Yeah.
I read in the book about a law like the Robinson-Tatman Act that's been in existence since the 1930s, right? New Deal era. You're not supposed to have the most giant company in the country that then pushes out competition and takes over markets. And because we know why, because prices can go up, workers can't negotiate their wages, those kinds of things. We have antitrust laws that need to be enforced in this country, and they're not being enforced. They have not been enforced since the Reagan era, mostly because the right-wing idea is that deregulation, right? Reaganomics was all about deregulation, sweeping away any kind of barriers to corporate expansion, to corporate growth. The reason we have Walmart as this giant, largest private employer in the country is because Reaganomics allowed that company to do whatever it wanted and pay as low wages as it wanted. And so, yeah, laws in Europe exist. They're enforced. And by the way, retail workers are unionized there, which is one reason cashiers sit down on the job, because they have labor rights when they demanded those kinds of protections for their bodies. But in the U.S., we simply have stopped enforcing antitrust laws. And one of the arguments I make in the book is that when you start doing that, we need to regulate. We need to break up these huge behemoths that are causing our communities so much harm.
At this point, Walmart's the largest grocery chain in the U.S.
I believe so, yeah.
Which I'm fairly old, too. So I remember when Walmart didn't even have a grocery store part of their stores. It's a somewhat recent development.
Yeah, it started to open grocery stores in the 80s because it saw the opportunity of, hey, I'm just going to impose any rules. So let's just take over. And they did.
Before we're done, I want to ask you this, because I saw you talking to Jason about it in the clip I saw. And this has been around for whatever, not long, but with surveillance pricing, right? Where the prices can change literally by the minute, not by every few days when a new flyer comes out. How's that work?
So this is the new frontier of pricing. This is what companies want to have happen, is that they want to be able to remotely change prices on the digital ticket on the shelf. So that could mean it's a hot day, and so they want to raise the price of ice cream, right, or water. It could mean there's low stock on toilet paper during a public health crisis, and so they want to raise the price. And that's already happening. Walmart's already announced that it's rolling out surveillance pricing in stores. But the real holy grail, what they really would like, is to know what individuals are in the store at that moment, right? So when you walk up to the counter, to the laundry detergent aisle, and you're looking at the options, that price will adjust based on, it'll give the price to Scott Parkin. This is the Scott Parkin price, or the Robert price, because it knows you. It knows what your income is, right? It knows from the from your online footprint, from credit reporting agencies. It knows your income. It knows what you normally spend on groceries in a week.
How does it know? Does it do a facial surveillance or?
Facial recognition resource is gonna know who you are, and it's gonna flash a price. It's already, I don't know if you ever bought an airplane ticket online, but that's how it works,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
When you're buying the airplane ticket, it's giving you a price individualized to your purchase.
Yeah.
And that's something that incredibly dangerous, and we need to fight against it.
Next time you go shopping, put on a fake mustache and a baseball cap and
a ski mask.
Yeah. Exactly. No, you're going to have to foil those systems. Yeah.
I think we're getting towards the end of our time. Bob, did you have any other questions?
A bunch, but no, it was fascinating. Like the stuff, like the part you wrote about Valentine's Day and the flower industry was really fascinating. Just the kind of the level of food waste, which I think we're all familiar with, but was even bigger than I assumed. And something that struck me, like I said, I've been seeing this, is it's just the type of workers there. It's no longer just a part-time job. I see I go to shopping. It's people who are like my age. I'm retired now. And people who would probably rather be retired are working quite a bit and putting up with all the hassles of it. So no, this is really great. I know you've heard this in many times, but it really, everybody says this, I think, which is, I think, a highest compliment you get is it's just like nickel and dime. It's a lot like the stuff Barbara and I did. And
I've not heard of you mentioned in the same sentence though.
Yeah.
I also have support from the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. I don't know if you folks support. This is a journalism nonprofit started by Barbara that makes the kind of story that I'm telling possible. So I'm really fortunate to have that support for sure.
Maybe last question is, when can people get the book and where can they find it?
The book comes out June 9th. From when we're recording this. Yeah. You can also, I have a website, AnnLarsonWrites.com, that you can check out. Or as I mentioned, economichardship.org. You can also see a curated list of my publication.
Another great article you have from last year in The Nation, which I assume is when you read this book, about how automation is worse than you think it is. That was a great read too. We'll put the link for your website and for that article in the show notes.
Wow.
And it's been great talking with you. Folks, the book is Clean Up on Aisle 5, Essential Work, Poverty, Wages, and View from Behind the Supermarket Register. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to us on an audio platform, give us a rate review. And if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. It's great talking with you. We'd love to have
Thanks
you on again.
For
other things that come up, we'd love to talk to you.
Love that.
Everybody else out there, make trouble and misbehave, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.